All right. I want to start in Matthew 23, actually, because we're going to get a little bit of a running start into what we're going to cover this morning, which is Matthew 24 and 25, if all goes according to plan. This is a controversial section and a challenging section. It's controversial and challenging because of some of the apocalyptic language that's used, because it is prophetic, and Jesus is prophesying about something that's to happen in the future. Because sometimes the wording is challenging, and sometimes it's just a difficult text to parse through on its own. So I'm going to do the best I can. I fully expect that you will leave here today, some of you saying, Jacob's got that totally wrong. I totally disagree, and I'm comfortable with that, knowing that ahead of time. But I'm teaching, so I need to teach you what I think it's saying, and we can have some discussion about that, although I would like to limit some of that discussion so that we don't spend the whole time on Matthew 24 and get nothing out of Matthew 25. Okay, so I want to start in Matthew 23, which we kind of touched on at the end of class last week. It's a series of woes Jesus has against the scribes and Pharisees, and I want you to notice how as the chapter unfolds, as it gets toward its end, Jesus' tone changes. And I want to remind you that Jesus has already told several parables that prophesy the destruction or judgment on the Jewish nation and the taking away of the kingdom of God from the Jews and giving it to another nation. So we had the parable of the vine dressers that indicated that, and we had the parable of the great banquet at the beginning of chapter 22 that pointed at that. Now look at 23, and he says this in verse 34, "Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" All right, so I think this section has helped if you think of Jesus in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets. Think of Jesus as Jeremiah or Isaiah, who is saying bad things are coming. And you can hear that in his tone. On this generation, all the blood of all these prophets is going to come. He says that in verse 35. And then he also says in verse 38, your house is left to you desolate. The word house in the Old Testament, when it's talked about the house of the Lord, is another word for the temple. That the temple is God's house. And when he says, your house is left to you desolate, especially combined with what he's about to say at the beginning of chapter 24, it indicates to me that he is prophesying doom on Jerusalem, particularly the destruction of the temple. That's going to happen. He's going to talk about that in chapter 24. So I hope you hear Jesus' tone, which is very foreboding and ominous, because bad things are coming, and he wants his people to be distinguished from the larger mass of the Jewish people, because they are going to know what's happening and understand why it's happening. All right, so chapter 24 and verse 1, it says, "Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, 'You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down.' As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" Okay, so the disciples come, and they are saying, hey, look, Jesus. In fact, the other gospel accounts say they're sort of pointing out how beautiful the temple is. Isn't this amazing? And Jesus is kind of a downer here, right? He's like, yeah, they're all going to be destroyed, okay, which is not really a nice thing to say when somebody's pointing out how beautiful something is, but he has a point to make. So all of this is going to be destroyed, and so the disciples, their ears perk up at that, and so they ask in verse 3, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So I don't know that the disciples understand that they are asking different questions. You know, like they're saying, okay, Jesus, we've got our pens and our our paper out. Now tell us, when are these things going to be? And then when are you going to come? And then when will the age end? As if they know what's about to unfold. In my judgment, it seems more likely that to a Jew in this time, the destruction of the temple is the end of the age. Everything is ending. If God is done with, I mean, think about what that looked like back in the exile when Nebuchadnezzar came and burned the temple. And it was the end of everything for the Jewish nation. And so there was this tremendous, read the book of Lamentations sometime, this tremendous desperation, depression almost, you would say, of Jeremiah, because God was just done with them. Is this it? Is this the end? And of course, there is that glimmer of hope in Jeremiah and in some of the prophets, but Jesus doesn't give that glimmer of hope here. He just says destruction is coming. So in other words, judgment is coming on Jerusalem, and they want to know when. They want to know when. So I think as broadly as we could say it, that's the subject of what Jesus is going to say in Matthew 24. I'm not sure that when you get done with Matthew 24, you have a good answer to the question of when. Because I don't know that that's really what Jesus is going for. It seems to me that Jesus is taking their question, as he often does with the disciples' question, and saying, I'm going to tell you what you need to hear rather than what you think you want to hear or what you think is important. Let's talk about Jesus' answer. Now, first of all, I want you to notice there is a word in verse 3, what will be the sign of your coming? And that word coming is used a couple of times here. Verse 27, as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. And then verse 30, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Okay, so you have this idea of when the Son of Man comes. Verse 44, the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. And it's easy for us, because I think we're a little bit separated from a lot of the prophetic language, to forget the way that the prophets use the idea of God coming in judgment. That is not usually a literal thing. So I want to, at the risk of completely derailing the class, I understand the risk before I do it. I want to ask you to put your marker in Matthew 24, and we'll come back in a minute. And I want to look at a few passages with you about this. Isaiah 31, we're going to look real quick. So go ahead and turn over there. We'll read it and just brief comment on each of these. Isaiah 31 and verse 4. This is one of those where those that are using the electronic Bible have an advantage. You get there quicker, especially in some of the prophets. Isaiah 31 and 4, for thus said the Lord to me, as a lion or a young lion growls over his prey, when a band of shepherds is called out against him, he is not terrified by their shouting or daunted at their noise. So the Lord of hosts will come down to fight on Mount Zion and on its hill. Like birds hovering, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will spare and rescue it. Okay, now let's sift through the poetic language there. Is God literally going to come down onto earth and fight? That's not really the idea, that God is manifesting himself in a physical presence on earth. But he is fighting. It is real. It is true. But how is he going to do that? What would that look like from our vantage point? It would look like armies fighting. But God is on the side of one of the armies. So God is going to protect it like birds hovering. The Lord will protect Jerusalem. Isaiah 26. And verse 20. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while until the fury has passed by. For behold, the Lord is coming out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. And the earth will disclose the blood shed on it and will no more cover its slain. So it says in verse 21, the Lord is coming. He is coming out of his place to punish. He is coming in judgment. What did that look like practically? Well, it looked like, in this case, the Assyrian army coming and judging. So if we were sitting here on earth, we would just see one army attacking another. In fact, we'd see Assyria dominating the whole earth. And we would say, I wonder what's going on here. And then with Isaiah's revelation, we would see, oh, This is God's coming in judgment. Isaiah 64. Verse 1, oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains might quake at your presence, as when fire kindles brushwood and the fire causes water to boil, to make your name known to your adversaries, that the nations might tremble at your presence. When you did awesome things that we did not look for, you came down. The mountains quaked at your presence. From of old, no one has heard or perceived by the ear. No eye has seen a God besides you who acts for those who wait for him. So you see a couple of times the idea of coming down in verse 1 and then in verse 3. I don't know that we're talking about a literal coming down. Do you get the idea? This is a poetic form Isaiah uses, Isaiah 66. I want to look at Micah real quick, and then I want to look at Daniel. Micah chapter 1. I'm singing the songs, the books of the Bible song. My hit. Micah 1 and verse 2. Hear, you peoples, all of you, pay attention, O earth, and all that is in it. Let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. Micah 1, 3. For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth, and the mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split open like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. All this is for the transgression of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. All right, so the Lord is coming out of his place. It's the coming of the Lord. Here he comes. What does that mean? Well, it talks about him, you know, walking on the mountains and like squishing them, and like it's being God in some kind of, I don't know, almost like a Godzilla-like rampage. Okay? Is that really the way that's going to look? Well, no. It is a figure to describe God coming in judgment. One more, Daniel 7. And this one is particularly important for what we're talking about in Matthew 24, Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, Daniel sees a vision of four beasts, which are different nations, rulers, and it's as if that last beast is terrifying and dominating. And in Daniel 7:13, he says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. And I also put verse 22, which says, the horn, 21, the horn made war with the saints until the Ancient of Days came. Okay, you see that? Again, coming, the coming of the Lord, the coming of the Lord. Here, you have this figure called the Son of Man coming in the Ancient of Days, who is God, presenting him with a kingdom. He is given dominion, and he comes on the clouds of heaven, it says there in verse 13. He comes on the clouds of heaven. Keep that in your mind, because that's going to come up in Matthew 24. The Son of Man coming on the cloud of heaven. I say all this to say, if you come to Matthew 24 with the idea that all of this language must be literal and cannot be God coming in judgment in different ways than literal return of Jesus, you might miss the context that the Old Testament provides to Jesus' words. If you view Jesus in the vein of the prophets, his words may sound a little different. And I want to encourage you to at least be open to that perspective about Matthew 24. All right, let's go back to Matthew 24. I told you to put your marker there, and I don't have my marker there. Okay. So we're 15 minutes in, and we haven't even gotten into the text. All right, so Matthew 24. Jesus' concern after their question is about how he wants his disciples to respond. Verse 4, see that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. They will lead many astray. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains, and they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So I think that the explanation Jesus gives is about when is this going to happen. He's just said the temple will be destroyed, and they asked when. And he says, don't be led astray. That's the first thing he says. Don't be led astray. There's going to be a lot of people saying a lot of things, and a lot of times you're going to want to read the signs. And you're going to say, oh, well, there's a war over here, and there's a famine and an earthquake. And he says, but that's not the destruction that I'm describing. That's not the coming of the Lord in judgment on Jerusalem. So a lot of this section seems to me to be about don't panic and don't think things are happening before they're happening. But there is a sign, so to speak, he wants them to watch for in verse 15. In verse 15, he says, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is in the housetop not go down and take what's in his house. Let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. Okay, so here is a clear set of instructions. All up to this point has been don't panic. See that you're not deceived. But here he says, when you see this, leave. So if Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and you are in Jerusalem and you see this, you need to get out of town because the bad things are about to happen. So you need to be aware of what's happening. And so what is the abomination of desolation in verse 15? Well, this is referred to in Daniel, and Jesus mentions that. When you read Daniel, it's pretty clear that it's not talking about this far future. It's talking about something during the time of, I believe, Antiochus Epiphanes. But this is another time when something desolates the holy place. Something is destroying and is defiling of the holy place. So I think we're probably talking about something like the Romans coming in and putting their statues and things inside the temple grounds, defiling what God had said. But something that had to do with the temple itself. And he says, watch out for this. When you see this, you need to leave and you need to flee to the mountains. He says in verse 21, then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. By the way, when you read that, that's a very common prophetic way of describing a really bad time. It happens several times in the Old Testament where they say, this is the worst it's ever been and will ever get. So it's a form of hyperbole that we use similar things. We would say something like, this is the worst it could possibly be, and we don't really mean that. It's not a literal thing as much as it is descriptive of something really horrible. Let's see. Again, you have this concern about being led astray. In verse 23, look, if anyone says, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. False Christs and false prophets will arise. And so, verse 26, if they say he's in the wilderness, don't go out. If they say he's in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Okay, well, yeah, that gets us in a whole other discussion there. Verse 28, what does that mean? Who's the corpse? Where are the vultures? Is this eagles? Is it talking about Rome? What is it? There's a whole set of discussions we could use about that. I am not going to, for time's sake, jump into all of that. Let me just say it this way. I think it's very straightforward up to this point in the text. Watch for this, and when you see this, know that it's about to happen. But don't be deceived by the other things that are happening. Just because things are bad in the world doesn't mean necessarily that God's about to come in judgment on Jerusalem. Okay, this next section, 29 to 34, I think we need to notice. I'm going to work through 29 to 34. I'm going to tell you what I think. 29 to 35. I'm going to tell you what I think about the whole text, and then at the risk of derailing the class again, I'm going to open it up for comments. Verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Don't know if you remember that, but we read that in Daniel 7, verse 13. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Okay, so I hope that you noticed in verse 29, for example, you have apocalyptic language. Very often, when some major crisis or event is described in the Old Testament, it is described in celestial terms. The sun will be darkened, the moon will be turned to blood, the stars will fall from heaven. And these things, again, we're Westerners, we don't like that kind of language. It baffles our minds. It is not literal. We're not saying this is literally going to, all the stars are going to fall down. Instead, it is describing a huge calamity, a catastrophe that's going to happen. In context, it's talking about the catastrophe that's going to destroy the temple. So you then have verse 30, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So I think we have the dilemma here. Are we talking literally that this is when Jesus appears and returns? Or are we talking figuratively in fulfillment of Daniel 7, where it said the Son of Man will come in the clouds or with the clouds? So 31 then goes along with that, sends out his angel to gather his elect from the four winds. And so I think a lot of people read that and it sounds like, you know, final second coming of Jesus, return, end of all things, you know, is gathering his people, that sort of thing. The difficulty with that is, he says in verse 34 that this generation will not pass away till all these things take place. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place, right? Okay, so if that's describing that, the end of all things, then it was going to take place in that generation. I think, and the way I reconcile this is I do not believe that 29 to 35 is talking about the end in terms of the end of time that we're still awaiting for in the second coming of Jesus. I believe it's in that prophetic vein that he is simply describing the coming of the Lord that has now happened over and over again throughout history, as I've shown you in the prophet passages. And it's going to happen again, Jesus says, when the Romans march on Jerusalem and destroy the temple, that is a way in which Jesus is coming back in judgment. He is going to come and judge them. And in this way, he's going to save his people because he's giving them instructions why they shouldn't be there when that happens. You need to be reading the fig leaves, the fig tree's leaves, to know what's happening and know that it's going to happen in this generation. So that is my way of reconciling that, and that is the way I think about that. This next section from 36 to 51, I view differently. I believe that 36 is a pivotal hinge verse, and that in verse 36 we change in what we're talking about from the destruction of Jerusalem to the second coming of Jesus. The reason I say that is because verse 36 says, concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. So here I would say this is different from when he says, read the signs, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee, when you see these things, be ready for them. You know, fig tree is putting out leaves, you know that the fruit's near, all of that. This is totally different. Now he says, nobody knows when that day and hour, that day and hour, I think, says something different. Now, I will just say, I'm not totally satisfied with my explanation or any explanation. Okay? And it is a thorny, difficult passage, but that's the way I reconcile it. So I take 36 through the end of chapter 25 as discussing when Jesus is going to come back. I think these are verses that are for you and me in the way that verses about the destruction of Jerusalem, they're not really as applicable to us because we don't live in Jerusalem during this era. So that's the way I think about it. Thoughts? Okay, I was worried I had beaten you guys into submission. Brother Jim is brave.
I don't have any answers, but more questions than answers. So, but I think of what you just said as verse 36 is a pivot scripture or passage. The word "but" there would lend itself to that. These changing topics. That day, I don't know what the original language is, but he seems to be talking about a different day. And I would say in the previous verse, he says, this generation. So again, that lends itself to your current explanation. And the fact that no one knows the hour. So he just told him he pretty much knows the hour. At least that's the impression I got. He may have not said that directly. But now as he pivots with "but" and "that day," and then he says that only God knows when that will happen, I think that supports your current argument. But that's different than total agreement with you, because I don't even know myself. So there you go. So good luck.
I do think he seems to know when this destruction of Jerusalem is going to happen. He knows it will happen in this generation. Now, someone might quibble and say, maybe he's being specific of the exact time, the day and the hour, even of the destruction of Jerusalem. Maybe he doesn't know. And I, you know, in that case, that's possible. It's a possible reading of it. But to me, I see a little bit of a difference from, hey, let's read the signs and be ready, to let's just be ready all the time, which is the tone of the rest of this section we're studying. Anybody else? Cortland? I mean, I showed you guys my cards, like they're all on the table. So,
my question about the literal part about the coming of man, what about when Jesus is crucified and it's darkness falls on the land and the earth shook? Is that not to be taken literal, or is it maybe that is somewhat literal? Like when Jesus finally dies, darkness falls over the land, and that's kind of what it says, is the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give light. The heavens will be shaken. We kind of see the earth shakes and the veil is torn in two. Is that that being literal?
Or no, I do think, like the way the gospel writers report that, it's this happened. Yeah. But I'm thinking even the Joel passage that's quoted in Acts 2 talks about the moon turning to blood. I don't think it's talking about it as, that day the moon turned to blood. It's more, this is a signal things are changing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a stock language. But I do think when those things happen, we're supposed to say, oh, well, something is changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's uncomfortable for us to, and we have to remember we're 2,000 years since there's been revelation from God. So that's a lot of history that we don't have, like, the keys to. What was God doing, and how did God act in each? What did God think about each nation and ruler and all of that, the way we do a lot in the Old Testament? I think it's a little uncomfortable for us to say, this is God's judgment. God's coming in judgment, even though we don't see him. It's a little easier to say, oh, well, God judged the Babylonians that time because he said it. So the idea of God coming in judgment through people or through armies is something that I think we're a little hesitant with, and the language bothers us. But I do think that's the way Bible people talked, including Jesus. So I think part of that is just a disconnect we feel. Yeah, go ahead, Cole.
I guess, in my mind, what does it matter either way? Why would it matter either way? I'm just more curious.
Is there matter of,
whether it's prophetic or if people really believe this is continued as part of verse 36? Like,
so it matters for two reasons. One is skeptics use this passage to say Jesus was wrong, and Jesus said everything was going to end in his generation, and he was wrong, which is a big deal. The other is that premillennialists will come here and camp out and say, here's the roadmap for what happens at the end. And so they talk about the Great Tribulation, which they get a lot from here, and they have a hard time parsing the text. I think just like everybody does, it's a challenging text. But they end up saying, we need to be reading the signs and waiting for these, you know, what's the next thing to happen? I'm not sure Jesus intended that to be taken that way. So those are the two main reasons, aside from just We want to know what Jesus was meaning, you know, aside from that. Yeah. Aaron?
We've talked about this before, but the history follows patterns over and over again. And what Jesus is describing here is a pattern that has happened throughout history, where God's people are persecuted. God brings judgment on the nation or the people that are causing the persecution, and then... And typically, you can kind of see it coming. There are usually things that happen that let you know that, you know, there's a point where you go, we've reached that mark in history again.
Right.
And so it doesn't have to be a specific pointing to things. The day of the Lord has happened, as you pointed out, repeatedly throughout history. And even in the last 2,000 years, has probably happened repeatedly in that time period of history, and will continue until Jesus actually comes back, will repeat itself throughout history.
I agree, and we're not talking about Revelation this morning, but I think that's one of the threads in Revelation. I think that cycle of the beast and then being conquered by Jesus happens over and over again throughout history. All right, one more. Jacob, you got the last word, and we got to move on.
I guess I've always kind of looked at this passage in that he's responding directly to the disciples' question in how it's laid out. And I think it kind of goes along with the way you've laid it out as well, in that he's, you know, they're asking, tell us when these things will be, and then what will be the sign of your coming, and then the last part, and the end of the age. And the part where he transitions in verse 36 is now getting into the end of the age, in my mind, piece of that, saying, but concerning that time, you know, no one knows the hour. And so I've always looked at it, he lays out the response in line with kind of how the disciples asked the question.
The questions that they meant to ask, or the question they probably didn't realize what they were actually. Because I don't know that they understood what the coming of the Son of Man would mean. I don't think they even knew he was leaving. But, yeah, I think that's a possibility, that at least he is, you know, let me answer this, let me answer this, let me answer this. In which case, you would see this is the end of the age section, starting in verse 36. Okay, so the tone I want you to get from 36 to 51 in chapter 24, the tone is you don't know when. You don't know when. So it is defined by that uncertainty that he starts with in verse 36. Nobody knows, so we're not going to guess it. And I think it's important that we say that because people throughout history have tried to guess it. Like, they try a lot. Surprising amount, considering Jesus specifically says you can't know. Like, he says, I don't know. In which case, if you get it right, you know more than Jesus, literally. You know something Jesus doesn't know. And I don't think we think about the hubris of that. Whatever it might be, we're not going to guess it. We're not going to somehow figure it out. So, because of that uncertainty, he talks about verse 38, as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. So if we're talking about the second coming, then this is saying people are going to not even realize it until it's too late. Just like in Noah's day, they were living it up until the moment Noah got in the ark. And then all of a sudden, the rain begins. So because of this, you get that familiar statement that it's going to happen like a thief in the night. Verse 43, if you had known when the thief was coming, you would have stayed awake. So verse 44, you must also be ready. The Son of Man is coming in an hour you don't expect. 45 to 51 has a little parable about being a faithful and wise servant who knows his master is coming back, and so he does not take advantage of the time when his master is gone. Instead, he lives in preparation for the master's return. Especially, Jesus seems to hint at something. You look in verse 48, he said, my master is delayed. What if it takes a while? This is interesting, especially given the time marker we had earlier in chapter 24, this generation. But now he says, what if the master is delayed? And what we're waiting for doesn't happen for a while. And then all of these in chapter 20, well, the two in chapter 25, the virgin's story emphasizes waiting, that the bridegroom is delayed. And the talent story says the master goes away and spends a lot of time in a far country and then comes back. So there is an interim. And these parables are about how we live in the interim. So I want to spend our last few minutes here in chapter 25. And there is a heavy emphasis here on waiting. And we don't like to talk about waiting. Do you know why? I'll tell you my opinion. I think it's because we don't like to wait. I think we really hate waiting. Don't you? Waiting is miserable and frustrating. It's particularly miserable and frustrating when you don't know how long you have to wait. You know, I think of this now that we have these map apps on our phones, and you can see how long the traffic jam is going to take for you to get through. Doesn't it make it like a little bit more bearable? You say, okay, well, that's going to add 15 minutes. And even if it ends up being like 30 minutes, you just get mad at your phone, but you're okay. You know, but when you just see all the taillights and you don't know how long, it's a helpless feeling. I think we're that way about Jesus' return. It's one thing to wait and say, you know what, I need to wait a year or 2 years or 3 years. But it's another thing to say, I just need to wait perpetually. And that's challenging. And I think that's what Jesus is speaking to in chapter 25, which means Jesus knew that everything wasn't going to end just immediately. He knew there would be a waiting period, and he prepared his disciples for, you need to be ready for me by continually waiting. 25, verse 1. The kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, notice that, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." That verse 13, by the way, takes us back to 24:36. No one knows the day or the hour. So if you don't know the day or the hour, what should you do? Watch. Watch. Be ready. So this is a story that seems to me to be about the emotional side of waiting and how we have to be prepared to wait indefinitely. So here it's pictured as the oil and the lamps. You know, did the wise bring enough to keep waiting and keep waiting and keep waiting? The foolish, though, they only bring some, and then they sort of run out. It seems to me that that's the message. Don't let your faith be, you know, just so big that you can only wait so long, and then you start to get restless and give up and say, you know what, I maybe this isn't real after all. I wonder... wonder if this doesn't have something to do with times of life, too. I have noticed that sometimes there, you know, when we get to a period where we've been a Christian, maybe 20 or 30 years, that sometimes people just say, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm out. I wonder if it's not a similar kind of problem. Like, what's the difference on an eternal time scale between waiting 20 or 30 years and waiting your whole life? Like, the difference is not that big, but it feels big to us because it's our lives. So in the same way, it seems to me that he is saying, you be ready to wait as long as that's going to take. The parable of the talents I talked about last week, which is entrusting property and assuming that the servants are going to do something with the property while the master is gone. So this is another story that gives us a mindset shift for what we're supposed to be doing while we wait for Jesus. We work while we wait. We work with the things he's given us. We cultivate those things. We use them to serve other people. And someday when the master comes back, which we know will happen, we're going to give an accounting for what we did with our time and with our money and with our talents and with the opportunities and relationships we had. Everything God's given us, we give an accounting back to him. So it pictures us as stewards who are waiting for someone to come and give us our final grade. How do we do with everything that God gave us? And the last story in 31 to 46 does not emphasize the in-between period. It emphasizes the end, but in doing so, it says what mattered about the in-between period. This is where Jesus comes and he separates the sheep from the goats, and he says, you, to those who were sheep, I was hungry and you gave me food, and I was thirsty and you gave me drink. And so they're all baffled, you know, when did we see you hungry or thirsty? And he says, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. When we serve Jesus' people, we serve Jesus. And when we ignore Jesus' people, we ignore Jesus. When we neglect one another, we neglect Jesus. And it takes the picture of, you know, how eager we would be if Jesus were here, how we would all throng around him, how we would honor him, how we would listen to his words, how if he needed anything, we would fall all over ourselves to help him. And he says, well, what do you do to my people? Because what you do to my people, you do to me. Jesus is that intimately connected to his people, but Jesus is also aware of how we treat his people, and he cares about that. So when he comes back, he is saying, this is going to be part of the reckoning of how I think about what you've been doing in my absence. So a lot of these talk about how disciples can be ready for Jesus' return. We're ready, and we're working, and we're serving each other. And in doing so, we serve Jesus. All right, last 5 minutes. Let's make it last 3.5. What have we learned about Jesus? First, we learned he knows the future, with that one tiny little exception, right? Which, you know, has its own sort of asterisk. But he knows that what's going to happen is that God's going to come in judgment on the Jewish people because of their rejection of him as the end of a line of prophets that they have rejected. He is coming back, perhaps in multiple ways, meaning he's coming back in judgment, and perhaps that's not an end of time type thing, but he certainly will come back at the end, and we have that promise. If not here, clearly, we have it in other places. He wants his disciples to be ready for him, and that includes working, and that includes serving, and he will judge us based on what we do in the interim. So here we are. We're still living in the in-between time, right? Still waiting. Promises on one hand, promises on the other hand, and we're here in the muddy middle, waiting for Jesus' return. Jesus knew that, and Jesus wants us to be ready by continuing to serve right now. What have we learned about ourselves? We are easily deceived and agitated. Did you notice that? How many times he said, don't be deceived, don't be led astray, don't be deceived, don't be led astray. Jesus knows us, and he knows we get worked up about stuff. And especially somebody comes to us and they tell us something and we get all excited. Does this happen to you? You get all excited and then you think, oh, this is it. And then you're disappointed. And that takes a toll on your heart. And it adds to our skepticism. He says, don't be deceived. Don't get worked up. Things will happen in their time. I mentioned this. We get tired of waiting. We don't like waiting. And so Jesus is aware of that. He tries to counsel us about that. We struggle remembering that the master will come back and evaluate us. I think we live in a world that really shuns accountability. And so it's hard for us to keep in mind someone is watching and there will be a performance review, so to speak. And that we need to be thinking about what does Jesus think about what I'm doing, saying, thinking, how I'm treating other people. Jesus says, I'm going to come back and talk to you about that. And the consequences there are severe. We need to know that this is a struggle we have. And so a text like this can be very helpful for us if we'll listen to it honestly. And then we can serve Jesus by serving others. One of the saddest things is that historically we have divorced those two things. That we love God, and that's just something me and God do over here. And then if I get around to it, I'll love my neighbor. But Jesus says, no, if you say you love me, you're going to love my people. If you say you want to serve me, you're going to serve my people. And if you serve my people, you serve me. That those two things are intimately connected. If you say you love God, how can you love God when you don't love man? 1 John would say. All right, so three questions for you and then we'll be done. How might Jesus' words comfort me and my anxiety about the state of the world? We get anxious about the way the world is going. I think Jesus' words hold something. There is a peace and a confidence that he has that no matter what all the craziness that goes on, that God's plan is still going to be accomplished. God's still in control. Things are still going like they should. And I think we need that because it feels different for us. And Jesus knows that. See that you're not led astray. Don't be anxious about those things. Am I waiting for Jesus? Am I really thinking about that? Anticipating that? Remembering that Jesus, the one I'm drawn to, the one I love, the one I want to see, is coming back? That he has laid that promise out there? And that even though it's been 2,000 years, that's still something we're waiting on? And then would Jesus say, I'm serving him by how I treat my fellow man? Would he say, you're doing it to me? Or would he say, you're neglecting me? All right, thanks so much for your attention. We'll pick up chapter 26 and finish off the book.